Well, joining us now is Arianna Huffington. She's the co-founder and editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post. Her new book is called, very provocatively, as I said before, Third World America, How Our Politicians Are Abandoning the Middle Class and Betraying the American Dream. Before we get to some of the issues that you bring up in your book, which are extremely fascinating, I wanted to get your response to the conversation we've been having all morning about the pastor in Florida, the event with the burning of the Quran, the involvement of President Obama and the Department of Defense. What is your takeaway from this situation?
Well, first of all, I'm stunned by the amount of attention that the media have given to it. I mean, I was on CNN yesterday to discuss the middle class, and of course there was nothing but breaking news about a nutcase with 50 followers maximum who has dominated our media coverage. And I could not help thinking that if we were giving 10% of that attention to what's happening around the country, to telling stories, which is part of our job as people in the media, we would actually be doing something for this country. And the other sort of irony here is that you have Petraeus and Gates and everybody worrying about this would do to the troops, while we have reports today about all the predator drones, the latest predator drones attacks that are killing civilians and wounding hundreds. What is that doing to the safety of the troops? What is that doing to increasing the kind of hatred towards America?
No, that's a good point. Do you think it plays politically in the 2010 off-year election, this whole distorted kind of mess?
I think what it's playing politically is, unfortunately, that the way in which more and more people are responding from their lizard brains to events.
Lizard brains.
Yes, which is what happens during periods of economic anxiety. Instead of responding rationally, people are responding irrationally, including to the building of the mosque in New York. So that's my biggest concern, because then sort of demagogues can exploit anything.
Well, we're going to delve deeper into your economic theories and what you think the Americans should actually be paying attention to in just a moment. We're going to take a quick break. Arianna Huffington, co-founder, editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post. We'll talk more in a moment. We are back again with Arianna Huffington. She is the co-founder and editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post. She's written many books, but her latest is called Third World America, How Our Politicians Are Abandoning the Middle Class and Betraying the American Dream. And I want to start by asking you about that title. You must have known people would be upset by comparing America to a third world country. And I'm wondering if you were serious about that, if you feel that's where we're headed.
Yes, I know it's a jarring phrase. I know it's very much contrary to our conviction that America is the greatest nation on earth, the most noble, the most generous, and very much still contrary to many people's experience. But the reason why I wanted to use this title is because I feel this is the trajectory we are on, and because we still have a window to prevent it. And so it's really important to sound the alarm in a way that will get people's attention so we do the things that will course correct.
Well, I wanted to kind of pick apart exactly what you think has happened to the middle class, because you trace it back to Ronald Reagan, and you're not partisan. You don't exempt either Democrats or Republicans from criticism here, but you blame Reagan, Clinton, Bush, and the Obama administration for contributing or allowing the death of the middle class to go forward. Could you explain how this has all started?
It's really kind of the takeover of our political system by special interests. And the fact that now powerful interests can buy public policy. We see it again and again. And we see the impact this has had on the middle class. Elizabeth Warren calls them tricks and traps that have been put in our mortgage contracts, in our credit card contracts. You can trace back, for example, the skyrocketing 28-30% credit card interest rates to a 1978 Supreme Court decision that made it possible for credit card companies to charge the interest rate of the state where they're incorporated instead of the state where they're actually offering the credit cards. And as a result, they're in Delaware, and which has eliminated usury laws so they can offer these teaser interest rates to our kids as they start college. I have a kid who is a freshman this year. And then in the small print of these 28, 29-page contracts, you discover that, in fact, they can put them up to 29%.
And the application is just a tear-off, really, there at college, right?
From a
bulletin board.
So this is like one small example of what has been happening.
Well, another example that you say is the takeover of our system, that we're not producing goods anymore, that we have financial services producing nothing. And in fact, you quote someone who said, what is bad for Wall Street at this point would be good for America.
Well, what's happening is that we went from a country that makes things to a country that makes things up. You know, credit default swaps, toxic derivatives with fancy names that CEOs told us after the financial meltdown they couldn't really understand. So that we've seen, you know, and I have the data in the book, how the financial industry has begun to take a bigger and bigger percentage, both of corporate profits and of GDP. So instead of being, you know, enabling the real economy, it's become sort of an alternative to the real economy. So we have this two-tier economy now where Wall Street is thriving and Main Street is suffering.
Well, you could say three-tier if you include the sort of military-industrial complex. It's also grown in the same period of time, and as we've had these sort of open-ended wars during Bush and now the Obama administration. But let's get back to what seems to be a real puzzle to me. How much of this is political and how much of this is sort of the end of the American century? Hillary Clinton talked about a new American moment. Many would say that what's happening to the middle class in the United States already happened in the UK. The end of the empire produced a huge financial boost to London, but the manufacturing sort of presence and the traditional middle class has declined. So you can go to places in England where it does seem like a third world country. That's what's happening here, and there's nothing politics can do about it.
There's nothing inevitable about it, though. I quote Arnold Toynbee in the book, who said that empires die much more frequently from suicide than murder. So we are bringing it on ourselves. And you're right that a characteristic of the end of an empire seems to be always, going back to the Romans, military adventures abroad that we cannot afford and we certainly do not need. We now are spending $2 billion a week on Afghanistan, a war that is certainly not making us more secure, a war that is unwinnable, a war where we cannot even define the objective, a war where we are basically buttressing a corrupt regime.
Well, let me ask you, you do tell some story. I mean, you have a little bit of condemnation for the media as well as politicians in your book. And you say that part of the problem is that we haven't spent any time telling the stories of the human faces on the recession. The couple of them really stuck in my mind. You told the story about a couple that got divorced only because, as divorced couple, she could collect her Social Security widow's benefits. And you told another one of a woman who sold her wedding ring on Craigslist so she could pay her utility bills. And I'm wondering, why do you think these kind of stories have not changed the debate in Washington?
Well, just think of how much time we spend telling the stories compared to how much time we spend telling Reverend Jones says, I'm going to burn the Quran story. You see, I think it's a proportion. I mean, we are all saturated with information. So there are exceptions in our journalistic enterprise. There are people who tell stories, but there are very few, and we don't have the kind of constant drumbeat that changes a conversation. At the Huffington Post, we have two reporters who are dedicated to doing nothing but telling stories. Literally, we are calling them our economic impact correspondents, and their job is to put flesh and blood on the data. Because I can sit here and give you all the data, 26 million people unemployed, underemployed, or discouraged to look for work, 3 million homes expected to be foreclosed, et cetera, et cetera. But if I can tell you the stories that I have in the book, if I can tell you about Brenda Carter, who had the same job in the same company for 11 years, and then she's fired one day and cannot get a job, after years of trying and is now making praline candy and selling it. First she was selling it door to door, now she's selling it online. You know, if I can give you a lot of detail about her, about what it was like to pick up all the little things that she had in her office for 11 years, you know, her pictures, her plants on one day, and the depression she went through. And, you know, that's how we connect with each other, through stories. And that's how we feel we can't let that happen.
But there's a political divide even in that story. I mean, some would say, oh, what a tragedy. They might be Democrats. Republicans would say, oh, what an entrepreneur. It's a happy story. Which is it?
Well, you know, here, that's a very good point you're making, because in my section on solutions, which is my favorite section, and if people only read one, I would recommend they read section 5. I actually say that this is a moment for us to reevaluate our lives, to tap into our own personal strength, because there are people who are crushed by economic hardship, whether it's a job loss, a home loss. And there are people like Brenda who, despite all the troubles, and she describes them in the book, has actually gone ahead. She's gotten her real estate license. She's selling cookies. I mean, God knows, I'm not glamorizing, and it hasn't been easy, and she's not making anywhere near what she was making in her safe middle-class job as an HR executive. But nevertheless, she is moving on, and she's doing things with her life. And absolutely, there are many, many stories like that. But if we tell them, we can encourage others to be inspired and move on rather than feel completely defeated.
Arianna Huffington, her new book is called Third World America, How Our Politicians Are Abandoning the Middle Class and Betraying the American Dream. In her book, she says, Obama's audacity to win morphed into a timidity to govern. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We return to our discussion with Arianna Huffington, whose new book is called Third World America, How Our Politicians Are Abandoning the Middle Class and Betraying the American Dream. And I wanted to talk to you about this concept that you bring up in your book, in which you talk about how so many political decisions are made based on the idea that the free market will solve our problems. And yet you say that the free market is a misnomer because the free market is not free. Explain that.
Yes. In fact, it's really amazing, because that's where there is a kind of beyond left and right consensus emerging, where a lot of capitalists who sleep with a copy of Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged beside them are recognizing that what is happening right now is not free market capitalism. And bailing out the big banks that took excessive risk and under pure capitalist rules would have been allowed to fail, right? I mean, they made the decisions, the free market spoke, that's it. Instead, they were bailed out by the taxpayer without any conditions. And you may remember with their AIG bailout of $180 billion, we actually paid Goldman Sachs 100 cents to the dollar. That's not free market capitalism. So what we really have is a kind of oligarchy, a kind of system where you can privatize your gains and socialize your losses. If you are too big to fail, if you pose a systemic risk, if you're sufficiently well connected.
But the counterargument there is, when Lehman Brothers failed, the chill in the marketplace from that bank going down meant that trade froze up all around the world. You couldn't get credit anywhere. Boats stopped sailing. The entire global economy went into this crazy, unprecedented kind of pause. Free market capitalism, in a sense, is too scary to work.
Well, I'm not saying that we shouldn't have bailed them out. I'm saying that if we were going to bail them out, we should have made some very clear conditions, like there had to be clawbacks.
Clawbacks of
bonuses
and profits.
Of profits. Right. There had to be restitution. There had to be rules about no bonuses. There had to be clear guidelines about how much they were going to lend back to help businesses start hiring again. And above everything else, there had to be some clear reforms, which, despite the financial reform bill that we passed, have not happened. We still have not eliminated systemic risk. We have not eliminated too big to fail. We have not reinstated, you know, the Glass-Steagall
Bank regulations bank from
regulations,
the Depression.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, many of the comments that you make about the financial reform bill struck me. You said it was very weak. And you talked about an incident in which Dick Durbin proposed an amendment that would have restored cram down to help homeowners, and that amendment was voted down. You say the amendment would have helped 1.7 million homeowners keep their homes and preserved an additional $300 billion in home equity. What kind of political situation in which on both sides of the aisle, Democrat and Republican, this amendment could go down?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for pointing that out. This is like the one fact in the book that explains everything. You know, how after the banks had wrecked the economy, after they had bailed out by the taxpayer, they were powerful enough to stop a common sense amendment that basically allowed homeowners the kind of loan modification possible for any corporation that is about to go bankrupt. And they had the power to stop it. And as Dick Durbin said, disgusted, the banks still own this place. And it's not even in the public interest. It's not even in the bank's interest to have so many homes that are now on their books foreclosed. What are they going to do with them? You know, the value of surrounding properties goes down. So even if you don't care about the families that have to move out into motels or with the grandparents or all the social problems that we're seeing as a result, just caring simply about the property values would have allowed the cram down to go ahead.
But the only thing keeping property values up now, a lot of economists say, is the fact that the federal government controls all the credit for mortgages. The federal government essentially subsidizes interest rates by keeping the Fed rates low. That if the Fed were to walk away from the housing market, the value of everybody's nest egg in the United States would like plummet. And that the argument of government get out, if you're talking about the housing industry, could be catastrophic.
Yes. No, I'm not saying that government should get out of the housing industry, which is completely toxic. I mean, I think we definitely need to rethink Fannie and Freddie and all that. But right now, what is happening with the easy credit, almost 0% interest that the Fed makes available, is that it's really also, again, continuing to help the banks that are getting all that money, and instead of putting it back into the community, they're sort of they're continuing to do all the risky derivatives trades that give them all those profits. And that's why one of the things I recommend in the book is for people to move their money, from the big banks into community banks, credit unions who have a site, moveyourmoney.info, where people can put their zip code and get credible information about the creditworthiness of the local banks. And the reason for that is that then you're kind of putting your money into institutions which are going to reinvest in the community.
You know, in there, I want to repeat this quote that you used in the book, which was Obama's audacity to win morphed into a timidity to govern. And yet you give a number of examples, strong examples, of proposals that would have been helped the middle class that were voted down in Congress before they ever reached Obama's desk. And I'm wondering, do you think he would actually be able to get stronger legislation passed?
Well, if he and his economic team had really not underestimated the economic crisis. Remember, they kept saying as the stimulus bill was going through that this was going to bring unemployment down to 8%. And many economists had argued, including Christine Romer, as we are finding out now, that in fact you needed a bigger stimulus. And I quote in the book Lloyd George, who said you cannot jump across a chasm in two leaps. So that was like their fatal error. You know, they had to do it right, because if they didn't do it right, we would fall into the abyss. And whether we're now going to have a double dip recession or not, the problem is that there is long-term harm being done when you're out of work for 6 months or more, which is what half the unemployed now have been out of work for 6 months or more.
Well, Arianna Huffington connects a number of dots. Everyone's been listening to statistics and reports for a long time. They're all connected in your book in terms of how all of these things lead to the suffering of the middle class more than any other. You can find an excerpt from Third World America at our website, thetakeaway.org. Thank you so much, Arianna Huffington, co-founder, editor-in-chief of The Huffington Post.
Thank you so much.
Also at our site, we've been hearing a lot of listeners reacting to Terry Jones, the Gainesville, Florida pastor who had originally planned to host a Quran burning tomorrow. It's now on hold as he heads to New York to apparently speak with Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf about the Cultural Center in Lower Manhattan instead. Here's what some of you have been saying.
We as individuals don't control other people's actions, but we can control how we react to them. So people shouldn't take it so seriously. It shouldn't be blamed for the problem of one man.
Serious or not, we'd love to hear what you think. 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm John Huckabee.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway. We'll